News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. Each week, we visit with veterans of World War II, and the idea behind the show is pretty straightforward. First of all, we want to preserve their stories, as it is our greatest generation, but these days, it's a dying generation, and that thought is not lost on us. We like to get them while they're still around to tell their stories and still feeling good about life, and that's the case for our guest today, Ed Scott, who's 88 years old, flew 25 missions in B-24s with the 467th Bomb Group in Europe. He was originally from Sanger, California. That's where he was born, right in the Central Valley, but spent his formative years on the plains of Kansas, a place called Madison, Kansas. And I'm guessing that's where you were on December 7th, 1941. What can you tell me about that day in Madison, Kansas?
Well, there's a lot of talk. And
let me get the timeline straight here. So you graduated high school at age 16.
Yes,
you were ahead of the game.
1939.
Exactly. So you're already out of school by 1941. So what were you doing at
that
point in your life?
I was in college. I started in college, and the war was starting to heat up, and I knew that I was going to be drafted. That was mandatory at that time. And I wanted to be in the Air Force. I wanted to become a pilot. So again, that's how things happened for me.
So you enlisted after the attacks on Pearl Harbor?
Yes. I enlisted in 1942. I decided to, as I said, to get into the service, and they had at that time a mandatory, some training for, lasted for 9 weeks at different schools around the nation. Different areas. And I was involved in that, and I went through all that training. And in 1943, late in the year, I was notified that I was going to be called. And in February then of the following year, that's when my service started.
Now, I've talked to a lot of guys who who wanted to be pilots, and they ended up doing something else. You actually got to do what you wanted to do. What was it about the idea of flying an airplane in the military that appealed to you? What about that seemed exciting and something that you would like to spend your time doing?
Well, just the thought of flying and the idea of flying was really, I couldn't think of anything else that that I would rather be able to do.
Had you ever been in an airplane before?
No. Shortly after that, I had the opportunity to fly in a Piper Cub with a pilot, and that convinced me right then that I would like to be a pilot.
So I'm sure you said, hey, why don't you build a plane that looks like just a big, long piece of iron, kind of like an anvil with some wings on it, and let me fly that? I'm sure you were dreaming of flying the B-24.
Well,
I didn't
know a B-24 from, actually, at that time, mostly the big name in aircraft would have been a B-17. Along came the B-24, and for some reason that it just appealed to me more than the 17.
Now, I thought you were going to tell me that you wanted to be a fighter pilot, because most of the bomber pilots I talked to really wanted to fly those smaller planes that were a little more maneuverable.
That entered in my decisions, too, and I was sent down in California, did some training there, and as we moved along, then they began to decide what they would do with you. That was my case. They decided that I needed to do something else beside being a fighter pilot. So they put me in a Malta aircraft, a twin-engine plane, and I did well in that. And I always and had we had to take tests all of the time during those periods, And I always remained in the top 10% of my class, which was a plus. So it just happened from then on. I began to move around the country to different stations.
Mm-hmm.
Accomplished that over a period of a year or two.
Do you remember the first time that you flew a B-24 and what that was like?
I don't know if I can put it in proper words. I was really proud of the fact that I was going to fly that big an aircraft,
mm-hmm.
and to get in it and have it checked out for me was really something.
Was that intimidating at all, to have such an expensive and intricate piece of equipment at your fingertips?
No, not so. I felt that I could accomplish it. I actually felt at ease.
Now, I've heard some stories from different B-24 pilots, and some of them are big, tall, strong guys, and some of them were a little on the shorter side, and some of those guys said they even had to put their feet up to use the levers to try to get that plane off the ground. I've heard it's not so easy to lift off with a B-24. What did you experience in that?
Well, there's more factors than just that you can just pull it back and it's going to take off. You have to have... The weather needs to be decent. If you have, and it happens a lot, it would be like around here, there's no breeze in the mornings, mm-hmm. at 6 or 7 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And you need air on those wings to lift. That's what causes you to lift.
Right.
And you need the power. You have to get it moving to a certain speed, and you just start pulling back on it and...
So did it come to you pretty easily, pretty naturally?
Yes, it did.
So you're flying a B-24, and you're responsible for yourself. And I'm sure you had plenty of training time in it before they shipped you overseas. But how did you wrestle with the idea of having a 10-man crew that was dependent on you and your skills in the cockpit?
Well, that was always on my mind, in a sense. But... I knew that I could fly an airplane. I had to convince the crew that was assigned to me, and at that particular time, we had there were 10.
Mm-hmm.
And I convinced them that I knew what I was doing, and I treated them with respect, and they helped.
And just to put this in perspective, because, I mean, we think, obviously, you're 88 years old now, and it's easy for people to look at you in that manner and respect you and what you've done. But at the time we're talking about, you're what, 20 years old?
Yes.
And how old are the rest of the guys on your crew?
They were similar in age.
So this is like, we're talking what we would know today as college kids.
Yes.
And most of us wouldn't put a whole lot of trust and confidence in a group of 8 or 10 college boys to accomplish a task as incredible as what you took on. What would you say was the unifying factor for that crew, and how did you guys get along? Would you describe it as what we think of as college-age men today, or did you feel like it was a little different back then because of the circumstances?
Well, I think it was different than that attitude, and each one of those men was a different character, but they seemed to meld together.
Mm-hmm.
And the big factor was that they had respected me, they had confidence in me, and I, in return, did the same for them.
Mm-hmm. And you must have had some growing level of confidence in your own abilities, too, to be able to take on what you eventually took on.
It became much easier as the more pilot time that you attained.
Were you getting antsy? Were you tired of all the training and the practice, the dummy bombs that you dropped and the practice missions you flew? Were you ready to get overseas and do something for real?
Well, I think I was ready, but it was always something in the back of your mind. Where am I going to go? How am I going to be able to accomplish what I need to?
Mm-hmm.
And the training that they gave us, they moved us around to different bases across the United States. Different areas, and you spent so much time in each one. And the more practice that you had in taking off, landing, and the confidence that you could do these things, it became easier.
And you said you wondered where they'd send you. Did you care? Did you have a preference? Did you want to go to one area of the war as opposed to another?
I actually thought that at that time, I thought I was going to be going to the Pacific because things were heating up there. As it turned out, they decided that they were going to eliminate Hitler first. So that's when we began to realize that that's where we were going to go. We were sent to Scotland and then down to England to a city on the called Norwich, England. And that's just right across from France, just not too many miles, really. But we did a lot of practice missions.
From your base in England?
Yes.
What was that like? You probably had to get used to the weather and the landscape and different flying conditions there as opposed to here.
There were a lot of conditions that, and especially the weather. At that time, there was always clouds. And for bombing, you just about have to be able to see the ground for the bombardier to be able to accomplish what needs to be done. You would take off, and it may be cloudy, foggy, not so bad that you couldn't do it safely. The other pilots would do the same thing, and we'd take off, and we would join. We would practice flying missions.
Well, we're going to take our first commercial break, but when we come back, we're going to hear about those missions back in World War II. Ed Scott, our guest today, will be back with more of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ. Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and I have three words for you. Ready? Duration, premium, cool. Duration Premium Cool Roofing Shingles from Owens Corning Roofing come with state-of-the-art reflective granules that lower the amount of solar energy entering your home. That means your AC may not have to work so hard, resulting in an energy bill that will go the only direction you ever want it to go, down. I did it. You can too. Find out more at owenscorning.com or ask for Duration Premium Cool at a Pacific Supply location near you. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K through 12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. This week, we're talking about B-24 Liberators, those big bombers from World War II. Some have called them flying anvils. I don't know if our guest today, Ed Scott, would go that far because the B-24 ended up being pretty good to him for his 25 missions with the 467th Bomb Group. Let's hear about the very first mission, because that seems to be something everybody remembers. The very first time you actually had a target that you're going to drop live bombs on, that you're flying with these other planes against the enemy. I bet that started early in the morning with some kind of briefing and description of where you guys were going. Do I have that right?
That's right. And it was usually early, usually 4 o'clock, 4:30 at the latest, that they would come around and awaken you. And your day would start from that. We would have time for breakfast. After that, then we would have meetings with the pilot group, and the bombardiers would have their group. They would have meeting navigators. So each group would have time to prepare for the takeoff time, which would usually then be maybe 7, 7:30.
Would you say you had some extra butterflies that first day when you found out where you were going and when you were going? And
I'm sure that I did, yes. But I'd flown enough and been around enough that that didn't keep me from accomplishing what I was supposed to do.
I'm sure along the lines of those 25 missions, there are some that stand out. And before we're done, I'll ask you about some of the photos that folks can find on KMJNow.com of a B-24 that has crash-landed. And I'm told the guy who pulled that off is the guy that I'm talking to here today, so I want to hear about that. But the rest of your 25 missions, are there some that stand out as being more satisfying, more hair-raising, more memorable for one reason or another?
Well, I don't know if I can pick out any single one, but as we started being able to go into Germany, then we began to realize that what we were doing was very important to our success. We needed to stop Hitler from being able to destroy the whole of Europe and possibly even England at that time.
So what were the kinds of targets that you were bombing that would be so crucial to slowing him down and stopping his big plane?
Well, originally it was the oil fields in Ploiești.
Ploiești, yeah.
Yes.
Romania.
Right. That was the original big bombing runs that they had. But then it began to, Germany was still accomplishing what they wanted to do, and it was our job to try to stop them. And it was the only way that they could really accomplish that was with aircraft. So then it became picking out targets in Germany that we needed to remove, and that's what we concentrated on, was primarily railroads, airfields, the Autobahns themselves, the roads, and the different targets that were there. And if we could destroy those, he couldn't move his war material or his troops. So that was primarily our thought most of the time, was to hit those targets.
Were you ever afraid? Did it enter your mind as a 20-year-old, a 21-year-old, a young man who doesn't have that much life experience to draw on? Did you ever worry? Were you ever concerned that in dropping these bombs on what were described to you as military targets, that there would be collateral damage, that that there could be your own troops that could be hurt or civilians? Was that something that you allowed to enter your mind or no?
Well, it was there, and of course they always, in their briefings, discussed those points, and that we had to be aware of those things. After a period of time, it didn't bother me that much. I knew I could fly the aircraft, and as I became a lead pilot, it was actually easier for me then, because the rest of the aircrafts had to fly off my wings. They had to accomplish what I was leading them to do.
What did you do to deserve that? Because when you're talking about being a lead pilot, before that, obviously, you had been flying all these missions in formation. Anyone who has read or seen anything about bombers in this part of the war knows that you're never on a mission by yourself. You never have the freedom to go wherever you want to go. You've got to stay in that formation, whether there's flak coming at you or not. What was it that caused you to be bumped up to a lead pilot on these missions?
Well, ability, for one thing. I could fly an aircraft. I had seemed to have the smarts enough to convince the leaders in our service that they could trust me to lead aircraft over Germany and accomplish the task. So.
And obviously that's a big part of the equation, but something tells me another part might be that some of the guys who were lead pilots had been shot down. That and this is something that I'm sure as a pilot in World War II you can't get away from, that you could be the next one to go down. That when there's a space opened up, it's because somebody's not there anymore to fly. Is that something that was hard to deal with?
Yes. It was constantly on your mind. You couldn't get away from that. But I trusted in the Lord. I prayed. and he watched over me.
Well, we're sitting here talking here right now, so I think that's pretty good evidence of that. And let's explore that a little bit. Now, I've talked to a lot of different people, and obviously everyone's different. Everyone has different beliefs. Everyone has a different experience. Some guys have talked about praying when they don't know what's going to happen. They think their plane's crashing into the ground. Other guys would do it every mission no matter what, and they might say the same ritualistic prayer. But when you say you prayed and you trusted in the Lord, what did that mean to you? How would you go about a mission, say? Did you pray more because this target was a little more dangerous than another one, or was it just kind of the same thing all the time for you?
For me, it was kind of the same thing. All missions are dangerous. Mm-hmm. Every time you get in an aircraft and try to take off, if everything doesn't run along smoothly, you're apt to be buried.
Mm-hmm.
So there was always that thought, that possibility. Mm-hmm. But as I said, prayer and my fortunate to get the crew that I was assigned.
Were you able to keep that crew together for most of those 25 missions?
Yes.
Now, that's fairly unusual in itself.
Yes, it's true.
What do you think was special about that group of guys? What did you guys share, or what kind of kept you together?
Well, it was just a group that meld together, and they had the respect that I could do my job and get them there and get them back.
Would you describe them as real serious guys or more on the joker side of the spectrum?
It was a combination.
Yeah.
We had a couple, three that might be serious, but the rest of them were just good, clean American boys.
I often ask guys who are on a bomber crew this question. Did you get the opportunity to name your aircraft or throw some nose art on the side of it? Or is that done for you?
For me personally, no, it was done for us. Somebody else had used that aircraft before or had the privilege of putting the name on it.
So what was the name?
Well, there were several.
You flew a lot of different planes.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Mostly by number.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much by the name. We had one particular aircraft that was Witchcraft.
Mm-hmm.
That was well known. And mm-hmm. It is not the same plane, but the name is around on an aircraft today, a B-24 today.
That's still flying.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only one that at the present time, anyway.
You ever end up in a plane that had something on the nose that you didn't really care for and said, why are we in this plane? Can we trade, get another one?
No, I never really questioned the front office, you might say. They knew where they wanted me. And as I improved and become a leader, mm-hmm. where I was the lead aircraft, and then I would, at that time, I would have another, say, a major or a lieutenant colonel or something flying with me as my co-pilot.
Mm-hmm.
Because he took care of all of that other stuff. My concentration was on flying it properly.
Some guys would say that would make them a little nervous to have such a high-ranking officer in the cockpit next to them.
Well, at first it does a little, but I think in most cases you get over that. You know very well what you can do. Most pilots do.
25 missions. How frequent was flak, and when did you get your first real taste of what that could be like?
Well, on the first mission, of course.
Naturally.
To start with. But it was, it's just something that it's kind of hard to believe. You're flying along, you're looking out in front, and all of a sudden there's a big burst, and it's right at your level, and you just got to feeling, you just tighten up your butt. Next one's going to be right on us. But we were fortunate. But that's you can't get past that.
And people who listen to the show regularly have probably heard me explore this question a lot, but it still gets me because you just described what it's like. And, you know, most people assume they watch the movies and they see dogfights and they figure, hey, if you're getting shot at, you can dodge this way or that way. When you're flying a bomber, you can't. You've got to stay in formation. You got to stay on the line toward the target. And you're just flying straight ahead right into fire that you know is coming at you, right?
That's right. That's right. Fighter pilots, that's a different proposition because they are up there trying to protect you. That was our protection.
Would you close your eyes when you knew the flak was about to hit the plane?
No. I didn't do that. My mind was on those instruments and just how steady I was doing my job. Of course, we had the automatic pilot after you got all straightened out, and that worked beautifully, but you still had at different times take control of the aircraft.
Did you ever try counting all the holes in the plane when you brought it back down?
There's one time where we really caught quite a bit of flak. I think it was around 20-some spots where there was damage. It's interesting when that happens and you actually can hear that rat-a-tat-tat that hits that metal skin.
Mm-hmm.
It wakes you up.
Sounds like you can kind of still hear it in your mind's ear right about now.
Well, yeah.
And any occasions where you were hit and it came pretty close to you or to where you were in the plane?
Probably the closest was it was in the back of me against the wall right there. That's close enough.
Close enough to get your attention?
Yes.
Were you wearing a flak suit that would have protected you somewhat?
Yes. Yeah, we had all of the types of clothing that we were supposed to use, but those flak suits were certainly lifesavers.
Sure. Well, I want to talk to you about some more of the equipment that you had aboard those B-24s and about this mission where you had to crash land your crippled aircraft and keep everyone alive in the process. We'll get those stories and more when we come back with the rest of Hometown Heroes today. 88-year-old Ed Scott of El Sobrante, California, our guest. We'll be right back on News Talk 580 KMJ. Rising energy bills got you down? Paul Leffler here telling you to look up. As in, look up to the top of your house and put your roof to work for your wallet. I want to tell you about Duration Premium Cool, the Energy Star rated roofing shingles from Owens Corning Roofing and Asphalt. I don't have to tell you how hot California summers can get. But did you know that installing a cool roof can help fend off that heat? You can take your pick from four distinctive colors. We have sage on top of the Leffler home. But what makes Duration Premium Cool shingles so special is the reflective granule technology that basically bounces sunlight back up to the sky so it doesn't get absorbed into your home. Duration Premium Cool shingles are proven to reflect up to 25% of that solar energy targeting your house on a hot summer day. So you may not have to use your AC as much, potentially giving your air conditioner a rest. So don't just get any roof, get an energy-efficient cool roof from Owens Corning. Find out more at owenscorning.com or ask for Duration Premium Cool shingles at a Pacific Supply location near you.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, talking B-24s today with 88-year-old Ed Scott. He served with the 467th Bomb Group. In fact, if you're ever around Savannah, Georgia, there is a museum in that part of the country dedicated to the 467th Bomb Group, and you'll find a plaque on the wall that heralds Ed Scott's crew as having the best accuracy rate in their bombing of all the planes of the 467th Bomb Group during World War II. He flew 25 missions, obviously survived them all. If he hadn't, he never would have met his wife. There would be 4 kids, 13 grandkids, and 7 great-grandkids who never would have been born if it didn't work out that way. We'll get that story. But back to your 25 missions in B-24s. You shared a little bit about some of the flak that you encountered. I mentioned that accuracy. Do you attribute some of that to how your bombardier was able to work with that Norden bomb sight from way up above the ground on all those missions?
Yes.
What was so special about that? How did that work for you guys?
The bomb sight itself?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was a new item that they had manufactured. It was a piece of equipment that just worked very well.
For your bombardier to be able to use that made your job a lot simpler, I suppose, right? That you could look at the big picture and get the plane where it was supposed to be. And now we're used to these satellites where we can get down to somebody's roof across the world somewhere. Yeah. I'm guessing at that time in the 1940s that having this bomb site with that kind of magnification was kind of felt like that, to be able to look somewhere that the human eye just couldn't take you. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
So, and it seemed that you guys really relied on that, and that had a big part in your success.
Yes. When the Bombardier took over, and he had control of the aircraft, he had the sight, and whatever he did with that would affect how the aircraft moved.
Mm-hmm. Means you better trust your Bombardier.
Amen.
And you did.
Yes.
And for those of you who've never been to the Veterans Memorial Museum, home of the Legion of Valor in downtown Fresno, I don't know what you're waiting for. I've told you about it so many times. But if you do go down there, especially if you go this week, make sure you look on the wall under the Distinguished Flying Cross that is larger than life there in the Grand Foyer, and look for Ed Scott's name on that list, because he is a recipient of the Distinguished Flying Cross for those 25 missions he flew during World War II. And I made reference to a crash landing. I understand this is just after Christmas of 1944, which we've heard a lot about that Christmas on this show. It's right in the middle of the Battle of the Bulge. We've heard about guys freezing their rear ends off in different places. What was it like to be flying during that worst winter that Europe had seen in decades? And how did you end up crash landing that plane on December 29th of 44?
Well, as you mentioned, the weather was lousy, and which is doesn't make flying easy.
And you were flying from England to Germany?
Yes.
Was it snowing?
Yes, there would be snow. There would be rain, sleet, ice. And our missions lasted, most everything was over 6 hours. 9 hours was the longest mission. Whew. That we ever flew. Mm-hmm. There. And that's quite a long time to sit in that one seat and hope that you can get back home with it. So, we only ran out of gas one time. Mm. And we were able to land in France at an airfield that was prepared for that procedure. So we landed in France and stayed overnight, filled up with gas, checked the aircraft out, and come on home the next day.
That sounds like a relief, because a lot worse things can happen to you when you run out of gas than finding a handy airstrip to land in.
Yes, I'm sure.
Some of those prayers were answered that day.
They certainly were.
This crash landing, December 29th, 44, your landing gear was damaged on takeoff or when?
That is what had happened. We were taking off, and the weather was bad. There was hardly any air moving. Of course, the 24, as we were speaking before, has to get enough speed and pressure on those wings to lift. And we did that, but then everything just seemed to fall apart, and we hit back on the ground solid. Real solid.
Slammed back into the runway.
Yes.
Ouch.
And then it was after that, we made it down the runway, and we got the aircraft in the air, and then we flew through some trees.
So you just did a double bounce takeoff, basically.
Pretty much so.
Not planned. It just worked out that way.
It just was fortunate that we bounced back up, and as I say, we weren't very far off the ground, and in moving out, we went through some trees, and that part of the plane was damaged a little bit on the wings. Then after we got turned around and moved around, we contacted the tower as to what they wanted us to do. And they sent us to an airfield that was built especially for this type of thing, for airplanes to land on, to crash on if they need be. Mm-hmm. And this we did. We went to that airfield.
So you didn't have a target. You didn't fly to on any mission. You just went directly toward this.
Went there because we knew the aircraft was damaged, and they sent us there now. And I knew we had a problem because in raising our landing gear, my signals were notifying me that it wasn't locked in. Because if everything is locked up right, all those lights will be off. Everything is working properly. Mm-hmm. But I was getting signals that there was something wrong there. Mm-hmm. And so when we went to this particular airfield, we landed, and I set the craft down as easily as I could. We were starting to roll, and as I let the nose wheel down, then the left landing gear broke off and flipped back into the tail section of our aircraft. And fortunately, we slid the rest of the way down the runway and got out of the aircraft and went in and signed that I wrecked an aircraft. God, I actually had to do that. And then they flew us home to England.
Mm-hmm. Well, you lived it, and I'm sure you've told the story a few times, so you just told us that like it was no big deal. But I'm trying to put myself in your shoes as, I guess at that point, a 21-year-old flying this very expensive piece of government equipment with 9 other guys on the plane with you. And I don't think I'd be very calm in that situation. What was it like for you? What kinds of things were going through your mind? Was this child's play compared to facing flak, or was this a little scarier for you?
I think this was a little more nerve-wracking for me. I had, on our plane, some wonderful guys. One of them had,
That's all right. Take as much time as you need.
He had a wife with 3 little girls. And there was never anything that bothered me more than to think of killing those little girls. So that affected me many times.
So on a lot of missions, not just this one, that was something in your mind, that those little girls would have their father and not have to grow up without him.
Yeah.
Wow. And I know our whole audience can feel how powerful that still is for you. And I guess you did well by those little girls that day, December of 44. Were you afraid for your own life at all?
Well, I didn't want to die. If that's what the question is. But I had a lot of confidence in what I could do, and I knew I could fly the aircraft. If I did my best, I could accomplish it.
Mm-hmm. So when you crawled out of that airplane after it skidded down the runway and the wheel broke off and hit the tail and all of that, what's the first thing you did when you got your feet back on terra firma?
Well, I had to go to the
You had to go sign some papers, huh?
There, and go sign papers that the plane had been crashed and all of the stuff that they need to make sure that everything is legal.
Now, I wasn't there, so I am asking from a complete neophyte's perspective here. You think it could have been worse that day?
Oh, yes. Yes, it could have. I could have killed 10 men.
And do you feel like, and maybe did your crew feel like, that your skill in bringing that plane down was crucial to all of you surviving? Do you think you had a hand in that, in the way you handled it?
They told me so.
What did that mean
and
to you?
And the kids talked to some of them.
You got to go to a reunion of your bomb group.
Yeah.
Other members of your crew were there?
Yes.
I bet that was special for you.
It was.
Did it make it make you feel like you were 21 again?
Well, I felt good about it.
When you look back on that and those 25 missions, and I know it's not easy to talk about all of it, but I think we've gotten a sense for the emotions that still stirs in you all these years later. When you look back on all of it, the missions where things went swimmingly, the missions where they got out of whack like that one, what are you most thankful for? When you think back on all the things you endured, what makes you the most thankful today?
Well, the Lord was watching over me. I don't know any other way of putting it. And my trust in Him is gigantic.
For good reason. Because He's been good to you the rest of your life, too. There's a little lady sitting a few feet away from you that you never would have met if that crash landing didn't come off the way it did in December of 44. Do you remember what it felt like to get back to America after being overseas, serving with all these other guys, knowing what you were up against and what was asked of you, and then to finally get back to the country you were fighting for?
Oh, it was a wonderful feeling. We had... When we started this process of them bringing us home, and we're in England, and we had a craft that we would fly home, and we picked that up down at the south end of England, and at an airfield there. Then we flew from there after we got everything settled. We flew from there down to the Azores, and that's a little island out there in the middle of the Atlantic. But we were fortunate and found the island all right. And then from there, we flew back up and into Newfoundland. We turned everything in, and left the plane there, and got on the train and came back down into New York, and then on towards home.
What was it like to see your family again?
Oh, it was hard to explain. It was terrific, wonderful. Of course, it was, for my father and mother, it was a great relief, and the rest of the family.
Mm-hmm. And at the time, you didn't have any other family, but you sure do now when we talk about four kids and 13 grandkids and seven great-grandchildren. So I've got to hear this story of how you met your bride. I understand it was your talented eyebrows that kind of opened the door for you. How'd that work? You're just out of the Air Corps, and they brought you into a place called California Inc. in Berkeley?
California Inc. in Berkeley.
Uh-huh. And what were you doing there?
Well, as I say, I was studying chemistry and geology, and that was a chemical lab, so... And I knew of that company from my brother-in-law, who had gone there and worked for a while. He had been in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went there and applied for a job, and they hired me right away. And I liked the scenery there.
What kind of scenery are you talking about?
Oh, well, just a smile and a laugh.
So I want to hear it from your recollection. You don't even know her name, but you see a girl walking close by, and you made eye contact with her, and you did something with your eyebrows. What'd you
well,
do? I want to know.
I'm not sure.
If my wife's upset with me, I might be able to use it.
You got to realize there's a lot of women in this world. And I looked at a lot of them.
Uh-huh. Shotgun approach.
Yeah, right.
So you'd tried this with the eyebrows before, but no one fell for it.
No, it was an interesting meeting, really.
Yeah, I know this is radio, so we can't see the expression on your face, but was it just simply the raising the eyebrows and making your eyes a little bigger for a minute?
I'm not really sure. It would have to be what she thought at the time, I think.
But it made an impression on her.
Yes.
So what happened from there? Did you ask her what her name was?
Well, I found out her name, yes. And we had lunch. and found out where she lived. She lived right there in Berkeley. And so our acquaintance began to grow.
Did you print up a little paper for her that said, "Hot pilot"? I hear that was the the term of the day, pilot.
I steered clear of all of that kind of
information.
People were kind of sick and tired of servicemen, in a sense. And so I didn't run around saying that I was a pilot and did this and did that.
Mm-hmm.
I was just happy to be home and starting to work. And
within a year or so, you were married?
Yeah.
And you're still married today, 65 years later.
Yep.
You ever think about that, that if you hadn't had those eyebrows working their magic that day, or better yet, if you hadn't survived those 25 missions, that there's 24 human beings who never would have been brought into this world?
I guess that's has entered my mind that at different times, but I don't really try to dwell on that. There's too many other wonderful things to think about.
Well, it seems like it would give you a lot to be thankful for.
Oh, immeasurable.
So when you think about that, when you think about these grandchildren and these great-grandchildren who certainly weren't alive to experience World War II and maybe don't even get that much in their history classes about it, what do you want them to know about what you and all those guys you were serving with, that crew that you love so much and the other men that you spent time with, what do you want them to know about what all of you were doing all those years ago?
Well, to praise the Lord for all the wonderful things that He gives them, and that their life is precious.
Mm-hmm. Do you think people today understand how different things could have been? Do you think we take our freedom for granted a little bit these days?
I don't think the majority of them understand at all. I think they're here.
Mm-hmm.
I think our legislatures, all the people that are involved, are sadly mistaken if they think that the United States is just going to be safe and they can do whatever they want when they want. We can't let that happen.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it kind of sounds like you're saying that freedom is not free.
Whoever said that knew.
Well, is there anything else that you'd like to share with our audience about your days in the Army Air Corps or everything you've enjoyed since then?
Well, all I can say to them is trust in the Lord and praise Him.
I can't argue with that. We're out of time on the program today, but I just want to thank you for serving our country and thank you for going back there with us. I know it's not easy. We appreciate you sharing your experiences.
Thank you.
That's Ed Scott, 88 years old, of El Sobrante, California, a native of Sanger for all you Apaches out there. And if you'd like to see what he looks like now, what he looked like back then, and even see that crash-landed plane, you can check that out at kmjnow.com or on the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And we'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.